Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is whether there are circumstances in which a person should have the right to purposefully end their life. Our guest is Dr. Larry Egbert. He's the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. You can reach us with questions and comments during the next hour or so in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Egbert, it's a pleasure for me to have this opportunity to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
Let me mention just briefly, Dr. Egbert is a retired anesthesiologist. He's also been a Unitarian Universalist minister. He's worked extensively as anesthesia at basically at major medical centers across the country, including Mass General Hospital, Johns Hopkins in Texas, University of Texas Southwestern University in Dallas. Tell us a little bit about the Final Exit Network, Larry, if you don't mind, just to get this program going.
Final Exit Network is an offshoot of the old Hemlock Society. The Hemlock Society was started by a fellow named Derek Humphrey, who lives in Oregon. And Derek, but he was originally British, and his wife had a horrible disease, a cancer, and asked him, would he help her die when she decided it was time, and they talked it over in great detail. He gives a lovely story about how their time together as she lived the last part of her life. And then he came to the United States because he was in trouble with the law in England, I gather, and settled in Los Angeles. And he created the Hemlock Society. With the Hemlock Society, it was basically education. So there were groups of people around the country in local clubs, Hemlock Society clubs. And somebody came along, I gather it was a rich elderly lady, who said, well, how come you don't, why are you talking all the time? Why don't you do something about these people who are suffering? And so they created what was called the Caring Friends. The Caring Friends program went virtually identically with what the Final Exit Network does now. The person calls up and says, I want to die, and the person answering the telephone gets a connection and has somebody call them back, and they ask the question, why? What happened was, with the Hemlock Society, is that they realized that this was not changing laws anywhere, and it would be useful to change the law. And so a group set up to do that, and they realized that one thing that was you could not do was to have a law changed for an organization that's named after a deadly poison, hemlock. So they got rid of the name. There is no major Hemlock Society anymore. There's some local chapters. This group is now called Compassion and Choices, and its headquarters is still in Colorado, where the Hemlock Society ended up, and also has offices in Oregon, in Portland. The same thing happened. A group got together and said, well, what about the patients now? It's good to change the law, but if you cut out things like actually doing something with the patient, which might get you in publicity, then we're sort of at odds with ourselves. If you wanted to change the law, you do not say you're a buddy of Jack Kevorkian. It's just politically not useful. Mm-hmm. And every physician would say, everyone I've met anyway, would say that. So the group Final Exit Network got up. We started out virtually imitating the Caring Friends program, where we would have a person who would come to meet you if this was acceptable for that person, and would evaluate you and make sure that you had thought through very, very thoroughly why you wanted to die. And also the person called a guide by us, the guide would say, well, I'm thinking through very thoroughly whether I want to be there while you do it. So you can go out and buy yourself a rifle. Mm-hmm. I would not be with you when you use the rifle. I would refuse to do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's the history of the organization. And we would go. We had roughly 3,000 members last time I heard, scattered around the United States. We also had a number of local chapters, a very lively chapter in Florida. We have a fairly lively chapter here in Washington, Maryland, Virginia. We'd call the National Capital Area Chapter. Actually, that's the National Capital Area Chapter of Compassion and Choices, and we work together pretty well here.
I'll remind our listeners as well, if you go to alaskapublic.org and the Line 1 website, you can find links to both the Final Exit Network and the Compassion and Choices organization. How did you get involved in the network?
Well, I was living in Texas at the time and practicing at the University of Texas. And one day I was leaving. Actually, this is the 7th of December of 1982. And I was on my way to go to the hospital, getting up in the morning, and read the newspaper that the state of Texas had used anesthetic drugs to execute a criminal, or a presumed criminal, in the Huntsville prison. They used the same drugs, and they didn't tell the dose in the newspaper, that I was about to go use in the hospital. And I've later found out that the doses weren't all that dissimilar either. So I made a lot of noise about this. And I looked up the research, and then I gave talks about it, and I actually ended up testifying for a murder case on it and that sort of thing. And somebody, what happened was then, the minister of my church, I'm not a Unitarian minister, incidentally, you said that.
Yeah.
I was a campus minister at the Johns Hopkins University.
Okay.
Which
okay.
is, I was called a lay minister.
Okay.
But my minister in Dallas called me up and asked me, would I do a euthanasia on one of our parishioners who was dying of a cancer of the lung? And I said, well, let me think that over a little bit. In other words, I would go do exactly the same thing they were doing in the prison for this lady, and the difference was that the prisoner presumably doesn't want it, and the woman wanted it very much. So I thought about it, and then I called the minister back and went and said, well, I'll come talk to you. So in other words, you can see the process of my mind sort of moving towards doing it. And the only question I can remember talking, we talked for about an hour, but I said, if I get into trouble with the police in the state of Texas, or am I on this alone, or are you and I together on this? And she said, we are together. So I said, all right, I'll go see the patient. So I went to see the patient. And she had terrible emphysema. She was gasping and wheezing away. She also had metastasis to bone and liver. And she had her husband there, was a very good friend of her first husband, and he knew that she and her first husband had been big-time cigarette smokers, and it was no wonder, and he had died the same way that she was now dying. So she was telling me their horrible story. The other person in the room was her daughter. The daughter started yelling at us and saying, Mother, you're not going to do this, and started just yelling at her mother. So I asked to be excused, and I said, I'll call you back tomorrow. And basically what happened was her daughter talked her out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to me was that I got very interested in the subject, and I've been interested in the subject of war since I lived in Lebanon, and you get interested in war when you live in the Middle East, and I thought this is worthy of considerable attention, so I did a lot of homework, and that's how I heard about the Hemlock Society.
We have a caller, and I want to take that call, but my first question that comes to my mind, if you had followed through in Texas, you would have been breaking the law.
Oh, yeah. And it would have been classified at least a euthanasia. In other words, if I injected it all, like Kevorkian did the last case he had, that would have been murder.
Right.
And
right.
Probably, I assume, murder one.
Right. And there is a little bit of, I'm not a lawyer, but there seems to me there's a little bit of difference between that and what Final Exit is attempting to do in the eyes of, with the idea of helping individuals.
Well, the key word that you use there is helping.
Right.
I can help by talking, like I'm helping people who are listening to this program, perhaps talking about it. That's help. What we separated, and we were quite adamant about this in our approach to the cases in Arizona and in Georgia, we separated very carefully helping from talking and from doing something. So if I write a prescription for you to do this, with Nembutal, say, I write you a prescription, that's a crime. That is doing something, and I give you the prescription. If that's a crime in Maryland, and I gather in Alaska, but it certainly is no longer a crime per se in Oregon or Washington.
Right. Right. And if this is always dangerous to read something, but I would like our listeners to be aware of what is a law in Oregon, and it's called the Death with Dignity Act, which was passed in 1994. It's actually been challenged by the Supreme Court and was not overturned, so the law remains, or the act remains, and it's that an Oregon resident who's been diagnosed by a physician with a terminal illness that will kill the patient within 6 months may request in writing from his or her physician a prescription for a legal lethal dose of medication for the purpose of ending the patient's life. The exercise of the option is voluntary. The patient must initiate the request. Any physician, pharmacist, or healthcare provider can refuse to participate. The request must be confirmed by two witnesses who are not related to the patient and not entitled to any of the patient's estate, is not the patient's physician, is not employed by a health care facility that cares for the patient. And after the request, another physician must examine the patient's records and confirm the diagnosis. The patient must then be free of a mental condition that might impair judgment. If the request is authorized, then the patient must wait 15 days and make a second oral request before the prescription may be written. The patient has the right to rescind the request at any time, and either physician could express concerns about the patient's ability to make an informed consent, or withdraw the ability to do this if the patient's request may be motivated by any coercion or depression. And the patient must also be referred for psychological evaluation. So this has been going on for 18 years in Oregon. Are there other states that have similar legislations that you're aware of?
Yeah, well, certainly Washington, two or three years ago, made virtually an identical law.
Okay.
Montana, about 2 years ago. In Montana, somebody went with a bad disease to a doctor, and the doctor said they didn't know what the answer was and went and checked with a lawyer, I gather. And the lawyer checked and said there's no law against it. And they checked with the judge, and the judge said if there's no law against it, that's true for the United States Constitution too, no law against it, you have the right to do whatever it is. So the state or the federal government or the state government has to make a law otherwise you're free to do whatever. And the state of Montana is at that stage now where you're free to do this. Three other states that I know of have been working on this recently, Vermont and Hawaii and New York. And New York and Hawaii, I don't know what their state is, and Vermont just voted it down last week, voted not to do it.
We have the caller. I want to go ahead and take this call, Larry, before we get into this any further. Leslie, you're on line one.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There's a particular problem with this, I think, in the villages in Alaska, because there are no hospices available, and some of the old-timers are very determined not to die in a strange place. I mean, some haven't even left the village, you know, in 10 years or more, so it's very uprooting to be, you spend your final days in a hospice in a strange city. So that's one problem, but I recently went through a death of a friend of mine in a village, and she had a signed statement on her wall from her doctor saying she was in the end stage of liver disease and was not expected to live more than 4 months, and she also had a statement, do not resuscitate statement, posted on the wall. The problem was her doctor refused to give her adequate medication, pain medication, because he knew that she was still drinking. And he felt like the combination of pain medication and alcohol could result in her dying, and he would be charged with malpractice or whatever.
Right.
So she refused to do that. So I felt it was very cruel to force my friend, who was an alcoholic, yes, but to make her die in pain, basically.
Right.
And I talked to her about her option of suicide. She brought it up to me, and she was very relieved to talk to someone about it because no one else would talk to her about it.
Mm-hmm.
And she showed me her options. She did have a gun. She right next to her bed. She had a stockpile of a few amount of pills that she was able to hoard away. And I found out what kind they were, and I went and looked them up on the internet because she wanted to know, is this enough to do the job? And so I looked it up, and I came back and I told her, no, it's about half of what you would need. And so we talked through all her options and whether maybe even taking that amount with her damaged liver would have been enough. But she ultimately decided not to because she was a Christian and the Lord says, do not come into my presence uninvited. But she was relieved to have been able to talk it over. And I went through myself, you know, would I help her? I had already kind of overstepped my bounds, I felt, even doing as much as I did. But I decided I would because I was so upset by that she was forced because she was an alcoholic and because of being, you know, sort of a hermit, that she was being forced to die an agonizing death.
And she did not want to leave the village to die.
Yes.
So it was a combination of those factors.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. Dr. Egbert, your comments.
Well, my first comment is that this doctor is not very strange. I've heard that story of doctors not wanting to get a person addicted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can laugh at that. That makes me laugh when I hear that. But the idea is so cruel, and there's actually now some real tendency to improve pain care and say that this should not be. In other words, the doctor should say this patient's uncomfortable, has a disease that's irreversible, has already made the prediction that the person is going to die in less than 6 months, and therefore, fitting this into the organ mentality, say, why not give a dose that is sufficient to stop the pain? People, when they get a morphine, for example, when they get morphine, they will get some relief. The increases, they get better relief. And as you increase the dose, the likelihood of respiratory effects, which is the reason overdose kills people with morphine, it's the reason morphine kills people, the likelihood of that becomes less as you increase the dose slowly to relieve the pain. The other thing about it is the idea of being addicted, she's already addicted, this poor woman, to the alcohol. And since that's, and the doctor determined that this is already killing her, I don't understand the point that the doctor has. Now, what I do understand is that the medical society in Alaska might give the doctor a very hard time. Mm-hmm. So that would suggest that you all get busy and change the laws. Mm-hmm. This is somebody from Maryland telling you that. But I think that is, in the long run, that's the solution for the community, not for this particular patient. For this particular patient, I would suggest that you might contact, and I don't have the number here, but contact the Final Exit Network. There'll be members of some chapter in Anchorage, I'm sure, and that person might be able to go to the village and sit with the patient and talk to the patient about the pros and cons of hastening death, other than taking proper medicine.
She's already died now, but for future reference, what was the organization you said to contact?
Final Exit Network.
Oh, Final Exit Network, okay.
Yeah. That and the other organization that would help with the education is Compassion and Choices. And they're both Googleable. They're slightly different in their style, but both are useful.
Yeah, and they're linked at alaskapublic.org for both of those.
Well, I did research what the law is in Alaska, and I saw that in some states it doesn't say anything. It doesn't really address specifically the issue of whether it's legal or not legal to assist someone. But we specifically have a law that says it is murder and you will go to jail.
Right.
So, you know, that seems like it's even harder to overturn than a state that doesn't have a law specifically concerning assisted suicide.
Yeah, from prior programs that we've done, and I'm a pediatrician, so I've not been at this situation personally, but on palliative care programs and my reading of the national literature is that there is more of an enlightened view that is much more compatible with what Dr. Egbert is saying, is that physicians should be supported in their ability to control pain under, you know, in almost any situation and not worry about consequences of being committing malpractice for if that's the purpose in what they're doing.
There are huge changes been made in the care of pain, too.
Right.
I mean, we really, really address this nationally. Excuse me for interrupting you.
No, I agree. And I think that's part of the point here is that at least in my mind, I think it's much more ethical to address the pain and suffering with medications rather than worry about whether you're going to get, as a physician, sued for overdosing or using medications inappropriately. I don't want to say that I don't think that would happen in Alaska, but I think there is enough understanding now that would seem much less likely than perhaps 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah, and the doctor did give that line to her about, I don't want to get too addicted, several months prior.
That didn't make any sense. I mean, I don't see how you can. That's the way I would think about it. What difference does it make if you're addicted, even if you are? And maybe you wouldn't be addicted. It's just, you know, we want to control that lady's discomfort as much as we can.
Okay, yep. Well, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Larry, let's talk about, if you don't mind, the final exits, the guiding principles, perhaps a little bit, so that people can better understand some of, as you said before we went on there, it's very similar to what is done in Oregon and Washington, but maybe not exactly. So, do you mind expanding on those?
Well, we've written them out and argued them very carefully. We hold that the mentally competent adult people have a basic human right to end their lives under several conditions. And one, that they suffer from a fatal or an irreversible illness or intractable pain. Two, they judge that the quality of their life is unacceptable to them. And I should add here that they've already made real efforts to get it some at least semi-acceptable. And three, they judge that their future is hopeless. But basically, we say a person has a right to do that. It's very similar to the right to use birth control, for example. There used to be laws against using birth control. Well, what business is of society to say that I can or don't use birth control? And the same thing with the end of life.
Mm-hmm. What
we said, the key there is the word choice. The patient makes a choice. We assume the patient's rational. Mm-hmm. That's U.S. Mm-hmm. law that says you're rational until proven otherwise, and therefore we assume everybody's rational. Now, it's a lot of people and a lot of physicians, I was certainly trained, that if a person wanted to commit suicide, they were by definition
right.
not rational.
Right.
So you had to work your way around that. But that's just not, we've rejected that as an idea. It certainly is not a legal idea.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the more common rational objections to this idea or these principles, or ones that, you know, make you pause to really consider and think about?
The most reason not to do this is the person really hasn't made up their mind. That's the most common one. Person will sometimes just feel badly.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pelvic fracture in a bicycle accident a couple of years ago, and the pain was so awful. And I was telling my wife I wanted to hasten death, and she got quite upset about it. And that, you know, as they got the proper dose of morphine into me, and then started the physical therapy, I finished. So that made temporarily I was irrational, and they worked me around past it. And it was a very short time that was true, too. Well, I think that the person one thinks it through very, very carefully. Now, there are mental conditions where a person might have their judgment impaired, But we have accepted people with chronic mental diseases in Fine Lexus Network, and with great deal of argument. And also, we have accepted people who have Alzheimer's disease.
All right. The Alzheimer's brings up an interesting question about, it almost seems to me that you'd have to have made these decisions ahead of time, so because they would not necessarily be rational at the time they may have decided to do this.
When a patient says they have been diagnosed and we check to make sure that's correct, they have a diagnosis, they are still legally rational and seem rational, and we use the term a window of opportunity. And the window of opportunity would say that if you become irrational, then we're not going to help you do this. We're not going to guide you.
Gotcha.
We're not going to be with you.
Okay.
And we do the same thing with physical. If you, amyotrophic lateral, Lou Gehrig's disease is the most famous one. Mm-hmm. You get to a point where you can't break up the pills, or you can't breathe the helium, fix up the helium. You can't do this because you're physically unable. Well, it's illegal for me to do it, and I'm not going to do it. So that you lose, suddenly the window closes, and you're out of luck.
Okay.
And we make that with Alzheimer's and with Lou Gehrig's disease, we make that very clear to the patient.
Okay.
And I've had both with Alzheimer's, where a person didn't wait and became incompetent, ended up in a nursing home. And another one who was competent enough, quite forgetful, but competent enough, and died.
I'm going to take our short break that we normally do somewhere through the middle of the program now. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and after this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails as we talk with Dr. Larry Egbert, former medical director of the Final Exit Network. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today the topic is whether there are circumstances in which a person can or should have the right to purposefully end their own life. My guest is Dr. Larry Egbert. He's the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our email or our phone number locally, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And again, just the warning that if you're listening between 7 and 8 o'clock local time in Anchorage, we will not be here. That's you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast. You've got about 30 minutes to send us your emails or questions before we will not be able to answer your questions anymore. It's been about 18 years since the Oregon legislation has passed and has been active. What's your feeling about our understanding about how that's working, and in particular, have there been significant problems or abuses that have occurred?
The general report that I have heard have been very favorable. One is that there are no people dying because they're poor, and it was a real worry that the poor people would be hastened to death. And actually, if there is a worry, it's that worry that the poor people aren't using it very much. Also, that this would be, everybody would be dying this way, was totally out of, didn't happen. The incidence of the actual use of it is less than 1% of the number of people who die in Oregon. The other thing that I think they were really worried about is that there would be people who really could be cured. And they have made it so thoroughly, they really fix it so that you can get checked out mentally, you get checked out physically, you have a double check, you have a waiting period, so that you get to think it through. And somebody, so I think that it's been a success.
Okay. Let's take a phone call. Penny, you're on line one.
Hello. I have a question about the Alzheimer's diagnosis. I've been a member of Final Exit for many years, and until, recently, it's been really theoretical. My sister, who is older than I am, is dying of Alzheimer's, and it's too late for her. She is completely out of it. I am determined I don't want this for myself. I don't have it now, but there is a partial probability that I will get it. What would be the procedure? In other words, in Alaska, I can't get a doctor to help me.
Well, the procedure with us, is with Final Exit Network, would be that we would say you can do this yourself if you remain physically and mentally still competent enough to do some of the chores yourself. In other words, we wouldn't send somebody to do things for you. We would send somebody who would make sure that you're mentally still capable of thinking this through, and that you would physically capable of doing some of the chores.
Okay, thank you. That's really what I wanted to know, because, like I said, it's been theoretical until now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Penny, thanks for your call.
Good luck, Penny.
Yep. All right, let's go ahead and take another call. Chris, you're on line one.
Hi. I'm just curious if perhaps this issue about assistance in one's end of life has more to do with economics. And what I really would like to pursue with both of you is, there seems to be a lot of money in the end-of-life issues. It's very costly for the patient, the family, everyone involved when it comes to that time. And doctors themselves, I mean, everyone profits from it. I'm always astounded through the numerous deaths that I've encountered in my life with friends and family, just how much that is true. I also feel that possibly we've been kind of held hostage by religious ethics, that basically, since Jesus Christ never had an easy out hanging on the cross, possibly we should not have that opportunity either. And I don't aspire to religious teachings. I'm not that way. But how do you feel about the economic ramifications? Yeah. That was ghastly, that one, the one woman who had the liver disease,
right,
who was not allowed an easier exit simply because her physician feared reprisal,
right,
and that meant his economic well-being would have been jeopardized. How do you folks feel,
right,
about that?
Right.
Thank you.
I'm going to let Larry comment, and then if I need to, I'll give you my 10 cents worth.
I know when the Congress was discussing the federal budget for medical care and Medicare, and that's like last year, this came up very dramatically, and I would assume that there will be a point where the government will say, well, we're just not going to pay for you to have medical care after a certain point. We do that now, and this is going to get more dramatic in different ways. So this is a real source of anxiety. At the same time, I would say we in Final Exit Network have dealt with this by saying we do this free. If you join Final Exit Network, you pay dues, like $50 a year, and if you can't afford $50, we'll work something out less. But the actual having a person being there with you, advising you what to do and how to do it, and sitting with you is free. We actually had one of our guys, started charging patients, and we caught him. Not only did we fire him, but we gave him his $50 membership back fee back himself. So this is important to say that morally, we're not doing this for money. There's no economic interest in this.
But there's an economic gain and from the medical community.
Right.
I mean, look how many people are profiting from it in nursing homes, et cetera. That's the angle that I'm thinking about, is I think human beings, when they're in the last stages of their life, or even other stages when they're in needy, are exploited by their inability to care for themselves. I think it's a form of exploitation. And if people are, you know, sane enough and able enough to take care of themselves and their wishes, they should be allowed to do so. I think it's from the other angle. I'm not worried about people simply because they can't pay to be cared for to die that way. I'm the opposite end. I agree with you.
Well, I think you should worry about it, because I think that there are a lot of people, I mean, we're not in Canada, and a lot of people are not being taken care of in the United States because of economics. And I think unless we have some kind of care so that all people are taken care of, at least the minimum practice of medicine, we're going to have this trouble.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm talking about at the end of life when they don't want care.
Right.
And they want to be allowed to leave Earth.
Right.
And that's one thing I think they're being exploited by, suspending their life indefinitely in terms of until their end comes, they shouldn't be exploited for in suffering. So I appreciate the work of your organization, by the way.
Yeah, I think any time there is the potential for economic gain, there's going to be bias no matter what anybody says. I mean, it doesn't affect everybody. But what we're learning from some of the newer cognitive psychology is that we all have these biases, whether we're aware of them or not. And so a reasonable argument would be is that there should not be any benefit for taking advantage of somebody's situation at the end of life, but so I'm empathetic to what you're also saying, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yep, you bet. Larry, there's a couple of comments that I perhaps have read that you've said that I think would make some sense to talk about as well. And in an NPR interview, you had mentioned that you didn't think the word suicide was appropriate in the work that the Final Exit Network does. If that's quoted correctly, I'm saying the right thing. Would you mind discussing this?
You said you quoted it as accurately as I could. What we left out in the conversation, and we were talking with Chris just a moment ago, she brought up the subject of religious. And I think that a lot of the real effort to not do this has been religious. And not economic. There's a real effort that people saying this is immoral, and then citing the Bible. And this is very clearly stated by the Roman Catholic hierarchy and a number of fundamentalist Christian churches. I'm not sure how to get around that. What I've said to people, I'll give you an example of a patient. I've had two who were fundamentalists, just found Jesus and really worshiping, were very lively worshipers of Jesus in the most modern sense. And one of them even tried to convert me, tried to get me to just believe in Jesus. And but they both of them had cancer, and they were suffering so badly that they were in this battle with themselves. They were going to be doing something that was immoral to them, not illegal, but immoral. It's not illegal to commit suicide. The reason that's the reason I don't like the word suicide, and I think that's the reason they changed the name of the law in Oregon. The idea of saying it's a dignified death, that to die in a dignified manner, is one way of doing it. Often when they're talking to us about actually doing it, using the word hastening death. Hastening death for a reason. That's basically the way I feel about it.
Gotcha. All right, Leslie has called back. She has another question. Leslie, you're on line one.
Hi. If you are dying, can you travel to a state where assisted suicide is legal, or do you have to be a resident of that state?
You have to be a resident of that state, and you cannot go to Holland either. What you can do is go to one of two organizations in Switzerland One of them is called Dignitas, and the other one is called Exit. And the problem there, of course, is the expense. It's a lot, much more expensive. If you were British, the British would take you, say, if you went and your husband took you to Switzerland and you were British, your husband would then be arrested. And I think they've just changed that to say that that's just wrong. But that's the only thing you cannot do. That you cannot go to Montana. You cannot go to Oregon. Now, you can move down there and live there for the rest of your year. But from what I've heard from what I've heard just the last few minutes, Alaska is so beautiful, nobody would ever want to go down to Oregon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Maybe it'd break up.
Okay.
All right. Another comment that I saw attributed to you that got my attention was in a Washington Post profile where you got their attention on the Washington Post. But you said you have some doubts at times about what you do. And that really is interesting to me. What do you mean?
Well, to generalize, I would say if you don't have doubts about doing something as complicated as being with somebody who's dying, then that's the time you should stop doing it.
Right.
In other words, being self-critical, we do this, I assume you did as a pediatrician, but we continually evaluate the work that we do so that if I have a case that I do a mediocre anesthetic on and colleagues, either my surgeons or the nurses or the other anesthesiologists, we have what we call mortality and morbidity rounds, M&Ms, and we'll discuss that case so that I'll be shaped up. Now, what we have now in the United States, except for Oregon and Washington, is that we have doctors who will do this, but they do it on the quiet. In other words, there's no evaluation. Say, well, you know, you really should have done this and not that. So I'm very uncomfortable with that. Anyway, that's where I am. The doubting, I think, is always useful. I actually hate people who are so sure of themselves that they know they're doing what's right.
Right.
I don't know about you as a pediatrician or as an epidemiologist, but I do. I've asked a number of people, have you ever made a mistake? Mm-hmm. And everybody said, well, of course I made a mistake. So then I'll say, could you mind telling me about one? Mm-hmm. And I have yet to find a person who will just sit down, it's casual and private, to sit down and say, and make it anonymous, to say that I did a mistake and this is what I did.
Right. Yeah, there's constantly new ideas, new information. We've all made mistakes. Any reasonably critical thinker, I think, has to be aware and constantly be asking themselves, am I doing the right thing? Is this the best thing for this situation? Is this the best thing for this patient? Is there more I need to know? And actually, the evidence is, I've been very much into this cognitive psychology stuff, is that it turns out that the more certain a person is about something, the more likely they are to be wrong. And that's been shown, particularly with the pundits who have an option of being right half the time, but it's been in significant, well-done studies, they're worse than a 50-50 chance. So what happens when we're really sure is we close our minds and we don't keep open-minded that we may be wrong and are not evaluating all the evidence. So I appreciate your willingness to say that. I think it's very important.
Well, it's also it's important to realize our own psychology, discomfort. I had a case one time when I was just getting a real start as an anesthesiologist, and I made a mistake, and it was 2 years before I was able to tell my wife about it.
Yep.
And right
yep.
now, as I'm telling you, just telling you this, I have goosebumps going up my arm with a horror.
Yeah. I bet a lot of physicians have been there and had that situation. I know. Yeah. I think I know exactly what you're saying and how you feel. I tear up occasionally about something that happened to me 30 years ago in practice. So, yep, it's difficult. Another thing about this is, I was thinking about it. I'm not sure I would It requires a certain amount of bravery, or it takes a certain amount of tolerance to really make these decisions and to do this. And so it implies to me that when people are making these decisions, to end their life, that there has been a huge amount of suffering. It's very difficult for someone who's never been there and in the old walked a while in their shoes to understand these issues. Can we, one, you could comment on this, but two, perhaps we ought to talk about what it's like the end of life with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, the Lou Gehrig's disease, and some of these other illnesses where you've been involved at the end of life, and what it's really like, and maybe try to paint a picture of how uncomfortable it might be.
Well, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, is one of the most horrible diseases I can possibly imagine. There was a book Visiting on Tuesdays or something like that, I forget the name, where a reporter who had become a quite well-known reporter went and visited one of his old professors who had ALS. And he, as he went through the, and so on Tuesdays, he'd fly from someplace like Detroit to Boston or somewhere and sit with him for an afternoon. And during that time, 6 months before he died. What happened is that the patient gradually loses muscle control. They may discover that they start falling down at unexpected times. They discover that it's hard to talk. They discover that it's hard to swallow, finally. And all of this is with no loss of their mind. So they can feel this. It's like they have a mind with no body moving, being able to move. And as muscle gives way, it's the nerves that do it. But the nervous system does it, not the muscles themselves. And the muscles, of course, then waste away. So that's what's horrible about it.
You know, it's that cognitive on being aware. And do people at the end of life also feel a burden, a guilt about the burden financially, the burden physically, the burden of taking other people's time and life away? How much does that contribute in your experience?
Well, in my experience, that's been very variable. Some people, it's as if they take care of me. And other people are spending a huge amount of time worrying about the others. I had a long discussion a lot of people were very uncomfortable with a physician who had four children, and one of the children had some psychiatric problem that needed, or neurological problem, I forget what it was, that she was responsible for his care economically. Now she's in her well into her 70s, and he's in his 40s, and so he's got another 30 or 40 years to live. And so she wanted to hasten her death to save him the money. Well, my reaction to that was to say, well, she had this beautiful home. Why didn't she sell the home and put it away for her son? So I was not very encouraging for her to do that. And we had quite an argument about it, saying she had this beautiful home. She could live much more simply in an apartment and say that she wanted to. And she also was smart enough and so that mentally she was worthy of being around. And she went ahead and died. And I didn't like that, and I didn't think that was a good idea. So I think that people are just plain different. I had one fellow who did not want to have his son there, and I was asking why, what was the matter with his son, and he said, well, his son wanted the money, and he just didn't want him around to help. In other words, the son was pushing him along. So we go to great lengths to evaluate each patient that we see to see that, or hopefully, to see that nobody is pushing him. So if you have a person who is has Alzheimer's. There's a book written, it comes from Hopkins here, about Alzheimer's, and it's called The 36-Hour Day. There's a whole section in the book about the care of the person who's caring for the person with Alzheimer's, because it's a 36-hour day. And so you can see how, well, the person would say, My jingles, I can understand why a person said, I can't stand this anymore. Why do I have to take care of my wife because she's got Alzheimer's, that sort of thing?
Right. Taking a life, even if it's your own, is a huge psychological issue, consciously, subconsciously, and we've talked about it from the patient standpoint. But I wonder, do we know anything about the consequences on the patient's family members once they have followed through with this? Is there guilt on the family side that they couldn't meet, you know, the needs, or do we know anything about the consequences of the family?
Well, the only answer I would have would be anecdotal from some of the cases where I do know. So I can't generalize very well. I do know that I have a patient whose husband had Lou Gehrig's disease, and she was just absolutely delighted to help testify in our legal problems. So she was saying, here we came to help him do something where he really needed the advice, he needed the help, and also that we were holding his hand. So we were just being with him as an outsider, but with a professional experience of doing this. It was interesting because this same case was present was his minister. The minister said after the patient had died, this was the most religious experience that she had ever had in her life. And so the wife is saying this is a very, very good thing. Another example is a fellow said when he was dying, he made it into a family show, and we got there to be with him while he died. And he said, would you mind coming back in a couple of hours? He had cancer of the prostate, and he was paralyzed from the waist down, and he had a lot of pain. And we were a little astonished to have him ask us to do that. And the reason was that he had a number of cousins who lived in the neighboring town, and they wanted to come over and be with him. So he ended up with 13 relatives, including some children, and a case of wine. And they came in and they gave the old guy a kiss and a hug and cried a little bit with him. And the thing that really moved me was that his wife's daughter, by her first husband, was there with him and kissing her stepfather as he was going to die. So this was a beautiful, loving, caring, both with laughter and tears and memories which being shared. And for me and my colleague, it was truly an honor to be there.
What about...
There's a fair amount of that in this work, actually, a fair amount of that.
What about depression? What about depression as a disease that makes people, you could argue, is makes them irrational, unable to make good decisions? And what about untreated, unresponsive to all medical intervention depression? Would that be a criteria that would fit within the final exit network guidelines?
Well, Thad, I think I mentioned earlier that when you went to medical school, if a person was depressed, they automatically were considered not competent.
Right.
And so that we could literally, and there's still a certain time limit now, how long you can incarcerate somebody who's depressed. My response to that, and final exit networks, at least up until 3 years ago, you'd have to check with somebody to see if there have been any changes. And I'm not sure about this, but we decided we would take such patients. We would be with them. And I'll give you an example of one of the cases that I had that when we did take it, she got depressed after being violently manic. She tore up a bar. She ended up in jail. She ended up in a psychiatric hospital for a couple of months. Then she did quite well. She did college. She had another attack and then another attack and another attack. So when we met her, when she called up and said she wanted to die, she could feel another one coming on, and she just didn't want to do it anymore, and she was 65 years old. Now, the answer, when I say people talking about this, are you saying that a person who is depressed isn't suffering?
No.
And then that's the first question. Okay. You're not going to say that.
Okay.
All right? Has that patient done everything possible to alleviate the suffering? All right, I have records. I had records on her psychiatric care. I had records from her psychiatrist. She'd had every drug known to psychiatrists that I'd ever heard of and could look up. And she also had electroshock therapy a number of times. And in doing, I did some anesthesia for electroshock therapy patients. And so we'd see the same patient again in a couple of years. Now, if a person gets depressed, say, every 2 or 3 years, a lot of people will tolerate that and tolerate it amazingly well. And this person said, I just don't want to do it anymore. Her husband had left her, her children had left her, and she was going to do it again. So then when we got there to her house, she here was this very attractive, educated, 65-year-old woman. And I said, oh, my God, you know. And then she went back to him. She went over the history. And, of course, I read it all very carefully. But to see her in the flesh and see her talking about it and her dreadful fear that this was coming on again. So now, is that reasonable? And most people that I've talked with, and I haven't asked you that yet, but most people have said, yes, that seems very reasonable. I said, well, suppose she's 55. I suppose she's 45. Oh, and they see what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I said, when are you going to say no? You won't do it. And I don't know the answer to that. I do know that I was very uncomfortable with 65, but essentially sat there and advised her what to do.
Let me remind listeners that if this is a stimulating conversation and you would like to get some more information, you can go to alaskapublic.org, line one, and on today's podcast there are some links that we've talked about to the Final Exit Network, the World Federation of the Right to Die Societies, the website of Compassion and Choices. There's a link to a list of all the state laws of all our states regarding this. And there is a very well-done documentary called How to Die in Oregon. There's a link to at least the information about that documentary and how to get that documentary if you would like to. Dr. Egbert, we're in our last minute or so, and I would love for you to kind of summarize the most important things you want our listeners to remember about today's program.
Well, I would say keep talking. That'd be the first thing I'd say. And you find that people do not like to talk about the subject, but the more that we can keep talking, and that to an individual patient, to bring this up, say you're a healthy 40-year-old, and to say to your mom, who's a healthy 70-year-old, Mom, what are you going to do when your time is getting near the end, towards the end? I mean, what do you want to do? Now, some parents will say absolutely they do not want to talk about it, and you have to respect that. But the idea of saying that I will bring it up with my parents, with my children, with my spouse, and also with my doctor.
Well, my thanks to Dr. Larry Egbert. He's the former medical director of the Final Exit Network. Thanks very much, Larry.
Yeah, my pleasure.
If you'd like to continue the program, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and our link is on at alaskapublic.org. Why don't you join us next Monday when my guest will be Dr. Jacques Pepin. He's the author of a very new book called The Origin of AIDS. He's an infectious disease expert and epidemiologist, and it's a wonderful description of what is the almost certain origin of AIDS as we understand it today. So why not tune into Health and Learn More April 23rd from 2 to 3 p.m. on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Smack, Spack is our web editor and our audio engineer. I want to say thanks for listening. And I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.